Programming is supported by Topline Construction Firm, your local women-owned roofing contractor based out of Shoreview, Minnesota. Roof replacement, both retail and insurance work. More information at toplineconstructionfirm.com.
You're listening to a recording of a live radio show on NPR News. If you want to listen to us in real time, you can stream our show live weekdays at 9 a.m. Central. Thanks for listening and enjoy the show.
Good morning, I'm Carrie Miller, this is NPR News, and if it feels like it's been a year since this happened...
Senator Harris,
we will let you all speak. Senator Harris.
You can't afford to wait for evolution on these issues.
Hey, guys, you know what? America does not want to witness a food fight. They want to know how we're going to put food on their table.
That's because the news cycle has been turbocharged. Think how much more we now know about the details of the Ukrainian investigation than we did the last time Democrats met to debate. And think about how that's shaping the arguments the primary candidates are making to voters. So we're going to take note of some of the latest news today. We're also going to talk about how some of the most urgent issues of the day are being discussed on the campaign trail. And that's where we'll begin as we anticipate tonight's debate. As our guests join us, two political scientists, I want to hear from you. Let's say you had a chance to stand up in the audience and tell these candidates about something that happened in your life, something that influences how you think. Maybe it's the illness of a loved one, and you really got a look at the dysfunction of the healthcare system. Maybe it's how difficult it is to make ends meet because you've got these overwhelming student loan payments. What would you tell these candidates about yourself and how that influences the way you think about government and who's going to end up as president? So think about a story about yourself, about your real life situation, and then how you would share that if you had an opportunity tonight to stand up in the audience and speak to these candidates. Here's the phone number, 651-227-6000, 800-242-2828, on Twitter, at Carrie, K-E-R-R-I-M-P-R. Our guest today, Todd Shaw, is a political scientist. He's a professor of African American Studies at the University of South Carolina, and he joins us today from Columbia. Todd, welcome. Really good to have you on the show.
Good to be with you.
Stella Rouse is with us. She's director of the Center for American Politics and Citizenship at the University of Maryland. She's author of the book Latinos in the Legislative Process, and she's with us today from Silver Spring, Maryland. And Stella, welcome to you. Good to have you on the show.
Hi, happy to be here.
And I hope first names are okay with both of you. This is how we usually do it on the show. Is that good?
Absolutely.
Okay, great. Stella, do the debates matter overall, and have these debates mattered more or less this political season? What would you say?
So I would say debates generally matter somewhat. I think it's difficult this political season, given the number of candidates that have been on the debate stage. I think they'll matter more once the pool is dwindled down a bit. We'll see. This is the first debate that we'll actually have all the candidates on stage just one night, not dividing it across two nights, which makes it difficult for a lot of people who are not political junkies to keep their sort of attention on this. So we'll see if it matters more tonight. But I would say at this point and at this stage, with so many candidates trying to distinguish themselves, it's been difficult for it to matter as it has perhaps in previous elections.
Okay, so far mattered less, Stella says, Todd, but has the potential to matter more as the field winnows. What do you think?
Yes, I would agree with Stella that there's a bit of political noise right now that is difficult for the candidates to break through, particularly those who are further down in the polls. But I will say that the closer we get to the end of the year and to the sort of turbocharged primary season, the more it will consolidate the leads of front runners and make those who are further down in the polls have to have some hard decisions.
Okay.
But at the very least, it can have some impact the closer we get to these actual primaries.
Yeah, so this is good to know. So if this feels chaotic for viewers, There are some important discussions going on, and hang on, because the import of the debates is going to get more, I guess, essential. Let me grab a call here. As Stella and Todd, as you know, I'm asking listeners to imagine themselves in the audience having a chance to stand up and tell these candidates something about their lives and how it shapes the way they think on politics and some of these issues. So I'm going to go to Molly in St. Paul. Molly, I'm so happy you took the challenge. Tell me what you would say to these candidates.
Yeah, thanks so much for taking my call. I guess for the candidates, it would be, you know, how are you going to help people that are in my position? And my position being recent college graduate, I started out with $32,000 in student debt, which is actually on the lower end of things, which is kind
of absurd. I know.
But I've been underemployed since graduation. I have to, you know, take jobs that are offering benefits. And now, you know, with healthcare, I'm paying hundreds of dollars in healthcare that I'm really not using. I don't have any buffer in savings because of my student loans, trying to start a 401k and basically just do all of the things that the generation ahead of me has said, you need to be doing these now, but not having the financial ability to actually follow through with that. So
okay.
I guess, yeah, kind of just end of millennials being hit from every angle. How are you going to help us?
Yeah. So Stella, I love the way Molly framed this. This is my life and this is what it looks like. And I'm trying to do the right thing. I know you specialize in politics and the way millennials are thinking about politics. What do you hear in that? And then what do you think? How do you think the candidates should respond to that?
So Molly's a perfect poster child as what we describe in my most recent book, Politics of Millennials, in terms of being saddled with student loan debt, being very educated, but being saddled with student loan debt, having suffered the major effects of the recession and trying to recover from that much more so than any other generation. And so she's a perfect representation of what somebody in her generational cohort cares about, which is trying to relieve that debt so she can, be successful in what the expectation is for her generation to be successful at the age that she needs to be successful for. And millennials really more than anything else care about what the government's going to do to relieve their student loan debt. They may actually be more moderate on other issues related to the economy and what the government should do, but they are very much fairly united in that the government should provide some relief for the student loan debt that they have incurred. And so that's a very, very important issue to them. And I obviously see how important it is for her to bring that forward to the candidates if she could.
Yeah. So Stella, do you hear enough specificity that seems like it could really work and be passed from the candidates?
Yeah, there are different plans across the candidates. Obviously, the Elizabeth Warren wants to help eliminate student loan debt. Bernie Sanders has put out a very ambitious plan to eliminate student loan debt for everybody, including those that are perhaps not in need of relief of that debt, given their income levels. Those are kind of some of the main things that have been talked about by the main candidates. Cory Booker has, and others who are a little bit more on the lower tier, have talked about reducing interest loan rates, forgiveness for particular employment benefits, for example, working for the government or doing some other things that would provide student loan debt. So there's a range of proposals that have been put out there. Some of them obviously probably more realistic than others, but I think the candidates have tried to address that issue, perhaps not enough to the satisfaction of millennials, but there are some different plans out there.
All right. Todd, on Twitter, a listener says, I would say I think about climate change every single day. I think about the world I'm leaving my daughter and everyone else's kids, and I think about how much politicians have failed us. Then I'd ask which one of them would fail me the least. Some cynicism there. I hear when the candidates are asked about climate change, almost all of them would say we would re-enter the Paris Agreement. Do you hear more specific ideas? I don't hear any of them talking about a carbon tax, by the way. Do you hear any other specific ideas that say, yeah, this candidate has really gone deep and this is something that they think they can pass?
Well, I have heard sort of support for aspects of the Green New Deal, which is the proposal from the ambitious proposal from Ocasio-Cortez.
Right.
And I think that there's probably the least amount of daylight, at least on the broad aspects of this. But you're right. I haven't yet, you know, and I'll just chalk it up to maybe I have missed those proposals, but I haven't yet heard about carbon taxes. I think someone like Elizabeth Warren has already proposed what she sees as this a bit, and I won't go into this topic too far, but she's proposed a very ambitious tax on the 1%. How much more of a tax you want to allocate toward those further down the income distribution would be a problem. And so maybe the one approach is sort of a broad a tax that would gather sort of these revenues that could be used for green. You know, I have heard proposals about sort of the aspects of the Green New Deal relative to, switches to solar power and boosting the arm to the solar power industry in the United States in competition with China. Mm-hmm. But yeah, the word taxation is probably not very popular particularly even within Democratic fields.
Yeah, so, exactly.
Yeah, I think you're right about that.
Let me grab a call here from Steve in Minneapolis. Hi, Steve.
Hello.
Hi. What would you, if you had the opportunity standing up in the audience to tell these candidates something about your life and how it shapes the political views you hold, what would you say?
I tell them I was a 61-year-old electrician.
Yep.
My two children just graduated from college. They graduated more or less debt-free.
Wonderful.
And that was mostly because we helped them by saving with a 529. I would address my question specifically to Elizabeth Warren and maybe a couple others who have signed on to the debt forgiveness program that's come in at $1.6 trillion. Do the math. That's $5,000 a person for every man, woman, and child in America. That's $20,000 for my family. I am not interested in paying other people's student loans. I'd like the candidates that do support that proposal to explain to me why I should be on the hook for other people's bad decisions.
Okay. So, Todd, I think that's a fair question, too. I mean, there are undoubtedly young Americans of need who need the student loan help. But this has been, Steve is really zeroing in on one of the criticisms of Elizabeth Warren's plan, which is that it sweeps some people who are middle income, upper middle income, into getting this student loan debt help. Is it a fair question, do you think?
Oh, I think it is. I think it's a fair question around the range of what is clearly a very redistributive approach that Warren, Sanders, and several others have taken. And I think that even though there has been, even though you will hear in the audiences of these debates, strong approval, particularly from younger voices who are clapping around the forgiveness of student loan, the pragmatics do come down to redistribution from whom to whom, or who to who, if I'm being grammatically correct. But along that proposal is sort of what can candidates say about, where redistribution occurs here? It's in exchange for in exchange for services rendered over there. And so I think it's just the long and short of it. It's a very fair question, and it's one where that will become even more fair as we get into the general election from the primaries.
All right. Todd Shaw with us. He's a political scientist and professor of African American Studies at the University of South Carolina. Stella Rouse with us, associate professor at the University of Maryland and the author of a book called Politics of Millennials, also an author of a book called Latinos in the Legislative Process. And we're asking you, as we take a look at this debate that is happening tonight among the Democratic candidates, We're asking you, if you had the chance to stand up in the audience tonight and tell these candidates about something that is going on in your life or who's kind of made you the person that you are today, and that something shapes the way you think about politics, what would it be? Would you tell a story like Steve did? Hey, I'm an electrician. I saved money. My kids got through college without a lot of debt. I don't know if I'm interested in, you know, spending a whole lot of my taxpayer money on helping other people out of debt. Or would you describe the situation of a loved one in the healthcare system and what you saw as a dysfunctional element of it? What would you say? What would you confide to these candidates? What are you looking for? 651-227-6000, 800-242-2828, on Twitter at @CarrieNPR, where Kate says, in 4 years, I've had two babies and lost my mother to breast cancer. Though I was allowed unpaid leave, in all, I lost months and months of lost income. How will a candidate support new parents and those grieving without paid leaves? Honestly, it's a mental health issue. Stella, this is a really big deal for the generation that's kind of sandwiched between aging parents and having new families. Do you hear the candidates address this enough?
They're addressing it. Whether it's enough or not, I guess it's open to interpretation and how important of an issue that is. I think what gets lost in the debate about healthcare is often mental health concerns and how to deal with mental health issues. And I think that's what the person you were referencing to was saying, talking about. So not only the burden that this person is carrying with taking care of older parents or young children, the mental health aspect, I think, doesn't get talked about enough, and that the candidates are not talking about that enough. It seems to be talked about in relation to perhaps gun violence in our society is brought up, but the general issue of mental health and how people deal with that and get the care that they need and how insurance or the government can assist with that really probably isn't being discussed enough. And I think it's a really important topic.
I wanted to ask you both about the economic populism and the way Elizabeth Warren and some of the others are talking about these issues. I was reading something that Julia Azari, she's been on the show. She's a political scientist from Marquette. She was writing about this, and she said, she talks about how these discussions about economic populism and racial justice have moved the party to the left. And she thinks that's where the tension arises between the candidates. Todd, I wonder if those are where we're really seeing some of the fissures and we're really seeing some of the differences when it gets to these ideas of economic populism and racial justice. What do you think?
Yeah, I think the Democratic Party in its continued attempt, and certainly the attempt of these candidates to cast a big net or to create a broad umbrella, always has to be mindful of how do you put together this effective winning coalition,
right,
with Democrats, certainly, but then independents. And I think particularly we've seen, let's take one issue of, and I bring this up only because I know it is a interesting but contentious issue around economic reparations,
yep,
for African Americans for slavery as one issue. That it is interesting because even in South Carolina, I have noted through a Winthrop poll that there's been some movement among sort of white or South Carolinians in the Democratic, likely voter poll,
mm-hmm,
and even among white Democratic South Carolinians, in favor of that that particular proposition, or at least the discussion of the proposition.
It's interesting.
Which I think is really quite intriguing that we've seen this sort of leftward shift. It is also true that sort of the economic populism of the right and Donald Trump has prompted an economic populism on the left. I think they're working in tandem here in key ways. But how far to the left and to the right is what bedevils all of the candidates, particularly someone like a Warren or a Sanders, who are clearly on the left continuum, on the progressive continuum of the party.
Stella, you know what I wonder about that, what Todd's bringing up on this discussion of reparations, is are we seeing more voters, say, willing to consider it, interested in the debate, because the discussion has grown more nuanced. There are more than... there are several, maybe many ways to think about how reparations would be made. So voters are doing a little more nuanced thinking on this. What would you say?
I think it's important to distinguish between conversations about that within progressive voter circles and conversations about that across the U.S. electorate as a whole. Certainly, it's an issue that has garnered a lot of attention, and people are willing to discuss a lot among progressive circles. I think when you pull the issue of reparations across the American electorate, there are a lot of people who are against it, who are against some of the proposals that have been put forward. So it's a very interesting tightrope that the candidates have to sort of walk with, as Todd said, sort of trying to keep this broad coalition together. And of course, the Democratic coalition is much more broad than the Republican coalition. The Republican coalition has gotten a lot smaller in terms of the issues that are important to that coalition, while the Democratic one has grown. And so they're having to balance this sort of progressive ideas that have to do with reparations, with student loan forgiveness, with holding corporations accountable, all this kind of stuff, along with trying to bring together enough people within the U.S. electorate to win a general election. And it's a tough tightrope to balance. But with respect to the reparations issue, I think we do have to keep in mind that there are perhaps two different conversations going on, depending on what audience we're talking about.
Stella, I don't want to miss what you just said. That was really interesting about how the numbers of issues that animate the different parties. I think I heard you saying it has narrowed among Republicans of the issues that they, I think you said, care about. It has widened among Democrats. Do you have a sense of why?
Well, I think it's the shifting evolution of the Republican Party and the voters that they have been attracting, particularly with the election of Donald Trump. That coalition is largely made up of older, white, high school educated, rural Americans. And that coalition just by itself in terms of demographics is just getting smaller, where that leaves a lot of people who have been in the middle in the past that the Republican Party represented some of their interests, either not affiliated with either party or looking toward the Democrats to broaden their sense of what they are offering to various coalitions. So from that respect, in terms of the evolution of what the party stands for, those coalitions have changed between the two parties over the last, you know, that change has occurred gradually, but it has really sped up during the Trump administration and during the 2016 election and what Trump was running on. And now you can see he's got, you know, 88% to 92% support among Republicans and the issues that he's putting forward.
Yeah.
I mean, it's really, you know, those issues are important to that coalition, but they are fairly narrow in terms of what they're voting on at this point.
Listener says on Twitter, I think we view presidents as having a magic wand on domestic issues when the reality is different. But on foreign policy, the president really does have an outsized role. He would ask, how would the candidates distinguish themselves? It doesn't come up very often. Jason says Elizabeth Warren specifically took up Jay Inslee's plan to tax carbon with a carbon fee and dividend. That's the moment I decided to support her after Inslee dropped out. To the phones to Patrick and Edina. Patrick, what's your question for our candidates?
Thanks for taking my call. If I had a chance to ask the Democrat candidates a question, it would be, don't you find it weird those who oppose Medicare for All or the Green New Deal all have donors from Big Pharma and Big Oil? The only ones that are for it don't have them as donors.
Okay, wait a minute. Patrick, I want to make sure I understand this. You are saying that the people that support Medicare for All, that's Bernie Sanders and Elizabeth Warren, what when it comes to their donations from pharma? Do or don't?
They don't receive donations from Big Pharma.
Got it. So
go ahead.
And what's the conclusion you're drawing about that?
I find it almost obvious to those who oppose it. For some reason, they get the donations from Big Pharma, from Big Oil. They have Big Oil, Big Pharma in their ears saying, you can't do Medicare for All. That's going to take our profits away. But simply just look at our country rankings, where we rank with education, where we rank with health care, recidivism rates, infant mortality. We get our rear ends kicked by Scandinavian and Nordic nations all the time.
This is something actually that came up yesterday when Senator Tina Smith was in the studio. We talked about how contributions from pharma are affecting the lack of legislation on negotiating on drug prices. So, Todd, that sounds like the larger question I hear from Patrick there is, are you, you know, in the tank with these corporate and lobbyist firms and basically unwilling to take a position that doesn't align with what they want? It is a good question.
It is. And I think for the Democratic Party, it cuts two ways. On one side, when you have, you know, individuals like, you know, Elizabeth Warren, Bernie Sanders, Cory Booker, Kamala Harris, in favor of something like a Medicare for All plan or versions of Medicare for All, let's be clear. And then you have, you know, sort of Biden, Bennett, Bullock, Delaney, Klobuchar, a little bit preferring something else.
Mm-hmm.
I think it is a fair question about that issue of where Big Pharma lands. Now, I will say this, that there's been these recent reports about you know, discussions, not so much behind closed doors as to sort of a, you know, a veiled threat from Wall Street that if Warren becomes your candidate, we'll sit it out or we will, in effect, you know, vote for Trump.
Yeah.
Don't know how, what's the veracity to those claims. And certainly Hillary Clinton, one of the critiques from the more progressive wing or further left wing of the party was around this question of big donors and big donations. In this day and age, smaller donations are some indication, and the Democratic and those who have determined who's in the Democratic debates have used, you know, the number of donors as one key indicator of support. But electoral support versus the dollars to run a campaign is a fundamental tension. And so the caller is right to at least ask the question, how do these line up? Do they line up perfectly or not in terms of support for certain policy proposals, given who the big corporate donors are supporting?
I have to say, I really love the fact that our listeners here on this public radio station are sophisticated and really interested in the way the corporate donations and lobbyist donations fit in with politics, because it can be really confusing. But we always get a lot of calls when we talk about it and people are really zeroed in on it. Mark says, if I was in the audience and they'd ask me, I'd say 12 people on a debate stage? Really? I'm a political junkie, but I don't want to hear candidates snarking at each other. And then he adds, Carrie, your show is going more in depth on any topic than we'll hear at the debate. And Stella, we've heard from some listeners this hour who are saying this is just too many candidates. Some of you that aren't going to make it ought to just drop out. Is that argument growing more compelling, do you think?
Yeah, I think so. I think it grows more compelling the closer we get to actual casting of votes in Iowa and New Hampshire at the beginning of the year. And I think the Democratic Party, the Democratic National Committee, has struggled with this issue. They want to give a platform to as many candidates as possible. The party wants to look to represent this broad swath of the American electorate and put people up there who have a lot of differing views and a lot of differing proposals for how to better the country. But at the same time, I think at some point there has to be some coalescing around a lot fewer candidates that can really refine their message, have time on a debate screen or debate stage to be able to get their message across. It's really hard with 12 candidates on the stage for anybody to really get their message across in just a few seconds that they have to answer questions. On the other side, there's candidates who are trying to make a name for themselves to stay in the conversation. And so that's really difficult to get any substantive information out of these candidates in this setting. So really, we do have to start, I think, dwindling it down as we are getting closer to actually casting votes, and that needs to happen. And I think it will. I think for a number of candidates, this debate is probably their last opportunity.
Do you, given the barriers to the November debate? Yeah.
Yes, the barriers are higher to the November debate. There's probably four or five candidates right now who, unless they do something spectacular in the debate tonight, are probably not going to reach those thresholds, those polling thresholds, the fundraising thresholds, to be able to make it on on the stage for the debates in November.
Keep the great questions here coming on Twitter and by phone. I love this idea that you're integrating your own life experience with the questions that you want to know from these candidates. One of the things I'm going to talk to Todd about on the other side of news is South Carolina voters are among the first in the nation to get a crack at these Democratic nominees on the primary calendar. They're among first in the voting. And I want to know from Todd whether he's getting a sense that that South Carolina voters are really starting to narrow and how they're thinking about the top tier of candidates. 651-227-6000 for your own life experience and how it fits into the kinds of questions that if you stood up in the audience tonight, you asked a question, what would you ask? 800-242-2828. And on Twitter, at Kerry, KERRIMPR. Back in just a moment to Lauren Rosenthal now with the news. And Lauren, what's your top story? Back to our conversation, Stella Rouse with us. She's a political scientist at the University of Maryland. Todd Shaw with us, a political scientist at the University of South Carolina. And Stella and Todd, we have so many people holding on the lines. I'm going to go right back to the calls, if that's cool with you, to Emily in Rochester. Hi, Emily. Thanks so much for waiting for through the news break. What are you thinking about?
Good morning. I am a Lutheran pastor in the Rochester area, and I've noticed that a lot of the people that I serve have a sort of political fatigue at this point. They're tired. They're exhausted. And I would love to hear the candidates make a case for civic engagement, like help people understand, empower people to understand why it matters to stay engaged even when it's exhausting, like it has been lately.
Really good question. I would love to hear Stella and Todd make a case for that. So, Stella, what does that sound like? Civic engagement, even in the midst of fatigue.
That's a great point by the caller. And I think the idea of staying civically engaged, even during this fatigue, it's particularly important, this fatigue. I think there are certainly candidates and politicians who hope that the fatigue will sort of depress the engagement of citizens, that they will be apathetic, that they will not come out to vote, that they can rely on certain core constituencies that are going to be there no matter what, rather than trying to engage the entire American electorate. So it's vitally important to stay civically engaged, particularly at a time when there's so much fatigue, so much coming at voters from all sides. The idea of misinformation and how that could affect or depress civic engagement is a huge issue that I think we as political scientists are grappling with and trying to understand and trying to overcome, trying to provide some solutions to overcome that. But that feeds into the fatigue because people don't know what to believe. There are things coming out from all angles. And what is fact and what is not fact, and what is legitimate news and what is not legitimate news has certainly added to that fatigue, coupled with people having just everyday life events that they have to deal with. They don't have time to sort of put in the time that it takes to be really properly informed. And I think candidates could do a better job of trying to deal with those issues and trying to engage the American electorate. And so I think we all have a responsibility as educators, politicians, to try and get the American public to be more engaged in politics, because ultimately the power is with the American public in terms of electing people who are going to make a difference.
Yeah, I'm going to follow that up as a journalist and say, Emily, I think creating a thoughtful, targeted media dashboard is really important, because I know the news cycle feels really chaotic and the news environment feels chaotic, but you can exert some control as a voter and as a news consumer over what you're taking in. So only go to high quality sources, but make sure that it's a variety of sources with voices from a lot of different elements of the American electorate and journalism. But create that media dashboard and be intentional about it and shut out a lot of the noise that really in the end is just noise. Okay, Todd, what would you say?
Well, Stella, as a fellow political scientist, knows this all too well that, we as political scientists discuss this about, that really the presidential election is a 2-year process, unlike Great Britain or a parliamentary election where you could do it in several months. We really do sort of grind down the public by virtue of how we conduct our elections. Be that as it may, I completely agree about the need for civic engagement, to see it as, really individuals get involved in politics when they're involved in the life of the community overall. And so whatever you're doing to improve life in the communities that you care about, you are to be applauded. And certainly those who engage in these things, like being involved in churches and in bowling leagues and a whole rest of other things, are the same individuals who are likely to also vote because they're mobilized or they discuss these issues with their fellow citizens. To your point, I would also say that it's okay to dip your toe every once in a while in the news and then, put things aside as they get a little trying. But to just stay informed at various points, there's days I just sort of look at headlines rather than try and spend hours, which could be quite tiring.
Yeah, that exactly. I mean, that's why the dashboard, right, the media dashboard, like choose the high quality sources and shut out a lot of the other news and dip in when you feel like you've got the mind space. Todd, I want to ask you something, though, about voting suppression, voter suppression, because that is a big issue in North Carolina, South Carolina. Is there cynicism about this? This is like the flipped side of engagement, right? Well, I would be engaged, but I'm not confident that my vote is going to be counted. How should candidates be speaking to this very real issue in some places?
Well, I think as the Democratic candidates, but this is also true for the Republicans, can simply reflect on the presidential election of 2000 and say, are you aware that that election effectively determined the president of the United States by 700 votes? given the conflict around counting those votes in Florida, that would make a difference of Al Gore or George Bush becoming president, in competitive elections such as we have, it critically makes a difference to vote. And also, again, Stella's a fellow political scientist, would highlight as well that, it's in our system, with the Electoral College being what it is with the presidential vote, it matters not just if you vote, but where you vote. Again, Donald Trump didn't win the popular vote in 2016. Hillary Clinton won that almost by 3 million votes. But Donald Trump got the necessary 100,000 votes or so across Wisconsin, Michigan, and Pennsylvania. And that, by design of our framers and Constitution, meant that he was president of the United States. So it really does matter if you vote. And particularly in, states that are battleground states with close margins. And Minnesota certainly could be.
That's right. We have a history of that,
state.
Too. Right. Kate called in St. Paul. She said, can we talk about immigration? I work with refugees. I just hate the discourse about immigrants and refugees right now. Our country was built on immigrants and everything seems messed up. And then I want to take another call about immigration from Chris in Sioux Falls. Hi, Chris. What would you tell the candidates about your own thoughts and experience with this?
Hi, Carrie. Thanks for taking my call. With my experiences, my wife actually came over here on a spouse visa 5 years ago. Mm-hmm. And then I have a friend who currently lives in California that she had errors on her immigration form through a service that tried to help her fill it out. Mm-hmm. Now, because of that and the way that our immigration system is set up, it's set up in a way that you get one shot and you're done. You make a mistake, that's too bad. No more chances for you. Now she doesn't have a deportation on her yet, but she cannot apply for another visa and probably will never have the chance at citizenship. And I think that's just completely unfair with the lack of counsel that we have, being both legal and other resources that people going through the process can go and get their questions answered. Because I know I had a lot of questions and I was always terrified at one misstep. And finally, on the grounds of, you think about the migrants coming up here, they're trying to flee from danger. I was always worried about something happening in my wife's home country while I waited for one whole year for her to be able to come back. So I want to know how a candidate, when they talk about immigration reform, what are you going to do to, one, make that process more forgiving when someone makes a mistake because we don't understand the legal jargon, and two, to really look at the cases and make them a little bit faster, get more bodies to handle these processing times. And that's what I
want. More resources in the system. Yeah, Chris, really good questions. Stella, do you share Kate's concern that the nature, the character of the debate about our immigration system is really just unworthy of the seriousness of the issue?
Sure. And I share the caller's concern as well about how difficult and unwielding the immigration process has become for people in his situation and his spouse's situation, in particular for migrants, for asylum seekers, for refugees. It's just become just an incredibly difficult process. And while I think it's fair that the candidates should really be forthright in their proposals for what they want to do on immigration reform, I think it's important to keep in mind that the president can only do so much when it comes to immigration. Really, where we are at with our immigration system is a failure of Congress, of both parties unwilling to come together to really pass comprehensive immigration reform to deal with some of these issues. So while the president can do some things, the president can certainly prioritize immigration in terms of the issue that he or she would want to bring forward in terms of their first 100 days in office and what they should do, that it really involves Congress doing something to solve this immigration crisis that we're really in as a country in terms of outdated laws, of new laws needed to deal with changing and emerging issues that have come up with immigration. And until Congress is willing to do something, really, I think nothing is going to change significantly when it comes to immigration reform. So it's not only important to try and hold our presidential candidates or our president accountable, but really your legislature, right, your congressmen, your senators, they are really should take some, some of that burden of speaking about and doing something about immigration.
It's such a good point, because I remember when George W. Bush was campaigning and then got elected, coming in with the idea that he had the knowledge and the experience and a Republican majority for a while to do something about immigration. And even he couldn't get anything passed. I mean, remember what happened with the Gang of Eight?
Absolutely.
Nothing happens. So you.
And it was hardliners in his own party that derailed immigration reform. So it really is important. That's a perfect example of how even a president with the power the president has trying to do something can't unless Congress acts. And so it's important as voters to not only put the burden on the president. Obviously, we see that the president can wield a lot of power. They can, through executive action, through redirecting funds, can do a lot of things related to immigration, and that's important to keep in mind. But I think fundamental change within our immigration system needs to hold Congress accountable.
I want to ask you both something that I heard David Gergen talking about this morning on CNN, and you know he's seen a lot of candidates and a lot of presidents and a lot of campaigns. He said he thinks that voters ask themselves, is this somebody that I want to live with? Is this somebody that I want to listen to for 4 years as they begin to assess who they're going to support? And he said as he watches these debates and he hears these candidates on the campaign trail, that some of them just need to lighten up. They're too grim, too serious. Todd, I hear you chuckling knowingly. Do you agree with that? Does he have a point, do you think?
He very much has a point, and political psychologists would remind us that having even sort of an emotional connection to a candidate fundamentally matters. That emotions matter as much in decisions that we may make politically as cognition or thinking. And so the do you want to sit down and have a beer with this person or with this person?
That frame,
it sounds on the face of it might sound a little silly, but it's actually true. Voters, you vote for people who you like or you have some sense of connection. I think that's why the degree to which candidates can tell a story that's a engaging story about their own life and their own story, about their own background really does matter.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Can I chime in on
Stella,
that?
Go ahead,
really
please.
Quickly? I think that's a great point that Todd's making, and conventional wisdom speaks about the likability of candidates. I think Trump turned that around on its head. It's very interesting to see results of surveys that show, and even focus groups that show, that Trump supporters, many of them don't like him, don't like how he behaves personally, how he tweets, what he tweets, how he treats other people. But in their mind, he's getting things done. Right. And so it's just interesting, I think, that we should keep in mind the fact that some of our conventional wisdom about electability of candidates may not necessarily play across the board.
And that's a really good point.
The Democratic candidates have actually, a lot of them have come out and said, if you elect me president, you won't hear from me. I'll be silent in the White House as a retort to the fact that we have a president that's constantly communicating and constantly dominating the news cycle. And these candidates are aware that perhaps people are fatigued about that and would rather go back to a president that is not making news
just
every day.
Just doing something and not telling us about it every 2 minutes, right?
Right.
I mean, Todd, the other thing that I think of with this is the different approaches, the different frames that we put on how we want the candidates to interact with us. You know, I'm thinking of gender politics here. Mm-hmm. The way the women are presenting themselves and need to present themselves has to be different than the way the men can present themselves on this. That likability thing is a real deal. There's a lot of research on this. And I think the women candidates have been calibrating this throughout the political season. If a woman ends up being the Democratic nominee, it's going to be very interesting to see how different it is this time from last time. What's your insight on that?
Yeah, I would agree. I think that it's both the sense that of the sort of implicit gender bias that these women candidates confront, and it's not her fault, but it is the shadow of the Clinton campaign and the degree to which there was defection for Clinton, it was certainly on the conservative end, but even white women voting in a higher margin for Trump over Clinton, ask this question. I think it also then brings this question to the fore about, are we ready thus for a woman president? And quite frankly, it's some bit of a silly question, because I don't think it was only the gender dynamic in the Clinton campaign for all the things they did right. There were other things they did problematic with regards to voter mobilization and then how they allocated resources in the sort of final stages. And that, we still unpack, was there a demobilization effect from Russian trolls on the internet to, just a range of ways in which African Americans or other voters weren't turned on. And so, that muddies the water, but what I would say is that we do have at least some sense among these polls telling us, Americans are ready for a woman president, at least in the generic sense. Which candidate it actually is will be a key issue. And certainly someone like Kamala Harris brings in the dimension of not just being a woman, but a woman of color, which is yet another sort of dimension to this question, or intersection, as we say, to these broader questions.
I said that about likability, and then I looked up here, and Naomi had tweeted, oftentimes likability is a double standard. Men like to use that as an excuse for not voting for women. Oh, many more conversations about that coming. Stella, thank you so much. Really great to have you on the show. And Todd, thank you. Nice to have you on the show today. Really appreciate your insight on that.
Thank you.
Great. Thank you much.
And you're listening to NPR News.
You just heard a recording of a live radio show on NPR News. To add your voice to the discussion, you can call in at 800-242-2828 or tweet us at @CarrieNPR. And if you miss us live, you'll find all our shows by subscribing to this podcast. You can send us your questions or comments by emailing talk@npr.org.